Chemical Watch podcast.
Unlock the full value of your compliance and product stewardship with world-leading insight and intelligence from Chemical Watch. To find out more or request a demo, visit chemicalwatch.com. Chemical Watch. Intelligence to transform product safety.
Hello and welcome to this week's news podcast hosted by members of the Chemical Watch team. I'm Kate Lowe, Global Managing Editor at Chemical Watch. And for today's episode, I'm joined by our North America Managing Editor, Terry Hyland, Asia Desk Editor, David McFarlane, and Emerging Markets Reporter, Ginger Harvey. The subjects we'll be discussing today include the latest developments in the establishment of the United Nations post-2020 chemicals framework. We'll also be taking a look at China's decision to waive its mandatory requirement for pre-market animal testing on imported general use cosmetics from the 1st of May. But first, let's start with the US EPA's announcement that it is reopening and seeking public comment on TSCA risk management rules for five persistent bioaccumulative and toxic substances, or PBTs, and that it has delayed enforcement of certain prohibitions on the flame retardant phenyl isopropylated phosphate 3-1, or otherwise known as PIP 3-1. So due to take effect last week, those prohibitions were finalised under the Trump administration, and their delay, along with that of four other persistent bioaccumulative and toxic substances, follows the Biden administration's ongoing effort to assess actions taken by its predecessor. So, Terry, can you tell us a little more about the PBT rules and what the EPA's actions here actually mean?
Yeah, hi, Kate. Sure. So these the five rules here, they restrict or even ban many uses of these five PBTs. And just very quickly, the substances here are, in addition to PIP 3-1, we have decabromodiphenyl ether, or DECA-BDE, and that's a flame retardant used in TVs, computers, textiles, and other applications. PIP 3-1, which, forgive me if in shorthand I say PIP 3-1, but it is used as a flame retardant in a lot of consumer products, including many electronics, as well as a plasticizer and lubricant and a hydraulic fluid. Then there's also 2,4,6 tris-tert-butyl phenol, or 2,4,6 TTBP. That's a processing reactant, and it's also used as an additive in fuels and lubricants. And then there's pentachlorothiophenol, PCTP, which is used to make rubber more pliable. And then the fifth substance is HCBD, or hexachlorobutadiene, and that's used as a solvent and as a hydraulic heat transfer or transformer fluid. And it can also be a byproduct during the manufacture of chlorinated hydrocarbons. So these the rules for these five substances, they were fast-tracked for action under TSCA, meaning the EPA skipped the risk evaluation process and went straight to developing these risk management rules. So that's why, you know, while podcast listeners may hear us often talk about the finalized risk evaluations for those first 10 substances, those risk evaluations are just finishing now, whereas EPA has already finalized these five rules for these five PBTs. And Kate, like you had mentioned, these rules, they were released in December, and they've already taken effect. Some restrictions are in place, while others do come into place after a certain period of time, sort of a phase-in. But now with its most recent action, the EPA here did two things. It said, number one, that it's opening a 60-day comment period on all five of the rules, and it hopes to get public input on a few specific areas. And that's whether the rules sufficiently reduce exposure to these chemicals, whether the EPA should consider additional or alternative measures or even different approaches in how it's regulating these substances. And finally, the EPA is seeking more information on some of these compliance issues associated with the restrictions that it's imposed on PIP 3-1. And then the second big thing, so in addition to that comment period for all five rules, the EPA is delaying enforcement of some of the restrictions on PIP 3-1. Specifically, the EPA is providing a 180-day no action assurance. So that's it's saying that it will not enforce the prohibitions on processing and distribution of PIP 3-to-1 for use in articles, and also to articles to which PIP 3-to-1 has already been added.
Thanks, Terry. So why is the EPA providing the 180-day delay on enforcement for PIP 3-to-1? And can companies seek a further delay if they need it?
Yes. Well, so many in the electronics sector in particular were caught off guard by the restrictions on PIP 3-to-1. It was a bit of a surprise just how widely used the substance is in electronics. And as I mentioned earlier, PIP 3-to-1, it's used as a flame retardant and a plasticizer in PVC wire covers and casings. And it's often used in those components within our laptops, TVs, as well as in robotics, manufacturing equipment, HVAC equipment, and even machines used to make semiconductors. And according to the EPA, the complicated nature of international supply chains to get all the components for these various products, it can make it tough for importers or even manufacturers to determine if and where PIP 3-to-1 is being used in various components, or to find a suitable alternative. And it's also complicated for a couple other reasons, as our editor Kelly Franklin reported in her story. Another Kelly Scanlon, director of EHS policy and research at the electronics industry group IPC, she told us that PIP 3-to-1 is not uniformly used throughout the sector. So it's not even a standard practice. It may be in some components, it may not be in others, which can make it harder for companies to sort of reliably know if it's being used or if it's not. And attorney Tom Berger from Keller and Heckman mentioned yet another reason, which is TSCA, the statute itself, often includes exemptions for impurities in products or for substances that are used within an article in a product. So many regulated companies were a little blindsided by these PBT rules, especially for PIP 3-to-1, because they were sort of accustomed to these common exceptions and they don't apply here. So they were a bit caught off guard. Even with all that, though, the EPA, when it sort of made this announcement, it noted that most companies weren't seeking an exclusion from the PIP 3-to-1 rule. Instead, they really just wanted more time to identify where this substance is being used in their products and how best to replace it. And EPA then decided to give companies an extra 180 days, roughly 6 months, to do just that. And James Votaw, another attorney with Keller and Heckman, said that for those companies that need more time than that, they will have to clearly demonstrate why that extra time is needed. And this could include providing an assessment of available alternatives, how much they cost, how long reformulations might take, and even discussing the extent of exposure to PIP 3-to-1 in a particular use. And sort of providing that information while the company is working to incorporate substitutions. And Mr. Votaw noted that it's critical for companies to come forward with this kind of information during that broader 60-day comment period for these rules. And that will give the EPA the information, hopefully, it would need if it decides to make any changes to the PIP 3-to-1 rule.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Terry. So what happens with the rules after this 60-day comment period? Are we likely to see changes and when?
Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting question here. So the EPA has said in this 60-day comment period, which covers all five of the rules, it said it wants to know if these rules as currently written are sufficient to reduce exposures to these substances. So that suggests that the agency is at least open to changing the requirements to make them more stringent, especially where they might see particular populations that might be at a greater risk. The NGO Earth Justice, for example, has said the EPA should include protections for workers who might come into contact with these PBTs. On the other hand, with its 180-day no action assurance on PIP 3-1, the EPA has already shown that it's willing to be flexible here where it sees that flexibility might be needed. So we're kind of in the interesting situation where you could get amended rules that could end up being more restrictive in some ways, potentially on worker protections, and less so in others, perhaps on dates for compliance or other exemptions. But the EPA can't simply snap its administrative fingers and change these rules. It has it does have to show a legally valid reason for making any changes because these rules have been finalized. So it has to follow certain administrative procedures. It has to go through the notice and comment process, and any changes that it makes, those have to be based on substantial evidence. And this gets back to what Mr. Votaw, I had said before, and what he had said regarding PIP 3-1, which is if a company thinks that the compliance dates should be pushed back for that substance, they need to submit detailed comments during this 60-day period so that if the EPA then is convinced and says, yep, we agree, more time is needed, more exceptions or carve-outs are needed, then the EPA then has sufficient information to justify that action. And it's the same with any NGOs or any public commenter. In their comments, they need to show why something is needed, be it more stringent restrictions or maybe more flexible compliance options. So that really makes this 60-day comment period, which opens tomorrow, that makes this period and any comments submitted pretty critical in potentially shaping any changes to the rules for these five substances.
Okay, thanks again, Terry. So now let's turn to China, where the National Medical Products Administration has finalized two regulations detailing the information and data required for the registration and filing of cosmetics and new cosmetics ingredients. Together, the two regulations support the implementation of measures for registering and filing cosmetics under the overarching Cosmetics Supervision and Administration Regulation, or CSAR, which came into force on the 1st of January. One of the striking features of the finalised regulations is that animal testing for imported general use cosmetics, and those cosmetics that are commonly used in hair, skin and nail care products, perfumes and makeup, has been waived under certain conditions. Those conditions are that the manufacturer provides certification or proof that they have implemented a quality management system such as ISO or good manufacturing practice certificates, and a risk assessment report demonstrating product safety. So, David, what has been the reaction to this development so far?
Hi, Kate. Well, the general reaction to this development has been that it's a step in the right direction. A shift from mandatory animal testing of all imported general use cosmetics to an ingredient-based and exposure-oriented safety assessment paradigm is a welcome evolution and one that will further align the Chinese regulatory approach for cosmetics with that of other major markets. This modernized regulatory framework, together with signals that Chinese authorities are prepared to embrace a wider range of state-of-the-art approaches to animal-free safety assessment, lays the foundations for improvements in consumer safety, product innovation, global trade, and animal welfare. So, toxicological tests can be exempted for general use cosmetics if a manufacturer has official certification, such as ISO or good manufacturing practices compliance certificates of the products manufacturers used as a quality management system or QMS and safety risk assessment results that can prove safety. However, fulfilling the official certification requirements in the regulations could prove to be a barrier for imported cosmetics, as many countries do not issue official QMS certificates. If the Chinese government requests that the QMS certificate comes from a government authority, then this could be difficult for companies, as many of these certificates come from third-party certification groups. Well, it is now well established amongst cosmetic manufacturers operating or selling in the EU to have available a report substantiating the safety of each product. Most regulatory systems for regular cosmetics are based on a pre- or post-market notification scheme that does not require or provide for a government-issued GMP or other quality management certificate. So in the absence of a government-issued GMP certificate and satisfactory product safety report, it would not appear to be possible for a company to forego pre-market animal testing for imports of general-use cosmetics.
Okay, thanks very much, David. Can you tell us more about special-use cosmetics and new ingredients which are not exempt from toxicological testing in new regulations? Also, I gather there are some exceptions where even for general use cosmetics, animal testing is still required. So is that right?
Yes, Kate. So special use cosmetics and new ingredients are not exempt from toxicological testing in the new regulations. And for general cosmetics, there are exceptions where animal testing is still required, which includes a product is for use by infants and children. A product contains new ingredients not listed in the inventory of existing cosmetic ingredients in China, or IECIC, that are undergoing safety monitoring, or quantitative and grading scoring results show that the filing person, the domestic responsible person, or the actual production enterprise are listed as key regulatory target objects. Although the CSAR and its subsidiary regulations do not expressly provide for waiver of pre-market animal testing of special cosmetics, they do establish a common principle of safety assessment based on ingredient safety and consumer exposure. This lays the foundation for more widespread recognition and use of contemporary animal-free approaches to cosmetic safety assessment, such as weight of evidence, read-across, and integrated approaches to testing and assessment.
Okay, thanks very much, David. So what's next with regard to animal testing? Do we expect China to move even further away from its use in future?
Well, allowing cosmetic companies to substantiate the safety of their products does align with manufacturers' responsibilities elsewhere in the world. And allowing these companies to use non-animal methods for their quality assessments of general cosmetics will also align China with the US and the EU. As long as the Chinese government can ensure a means to controlling the safety of special use cosmetics and or new ingredients without toxicology tests, it's expected that they will approve a more positive legislation on waiving animal testing in the next 3 to 5 years.
Okay, thanks again, David. So finally, let's turn to the United Nations and the talks that have been taking place between governments, industry, NGOs, and other stakeholders in a bid to establish a post-2020 international chemicals framework. Last week, we reported that talks which have been taking place virtually since the start of the pandemic have moved closer to agreement on the key negotiating issues for the framework, including private sector financing and the need for a science policy interface on chemicals. These virtual talks have been taking place with the members of 4 working groups focusing on a variety of key issues between them, one of the most important being how to fund the work of the framework in future. So, Ginger, perhaps you could start by telling us more about the aims of the finance working group and the conclusions it has come to.
Hi, Kate. Sure. So as you said, the financing is a really important aspect of the post-2020 framework because it aims to find sufficient and sustainable funding for global chemicals management. It doesn't matter what all the other groups agree and what the framework hopes to do if there's no money, both within the UN and within individual countries to implement it. In this working group that's been going on for the last 4 months or so, and actually, even before that, everyone has agreed to a 3-pronged approach to funding. And these 3 prongs are, first, external financing, or some sort of dedicated funds from the international arena devoted to chemicals. The second one is mainstreaming, which would be within individual countries sort of weaving the chemicals agenda into domestic sources of funding like grants for broader sustainability projects or national budgets, having something specific for chemicals within pots of funding that already exist. And then the third prong is private sector involvement, so the industry's contributions. Now, this final aspect has been pretty controversial. NGOs have put forward a proposal, and the African countries, the African group within the UN has agreed with this proposal for the post-2020 framework to lay the groundwork for countries to set up a global tax on the chemicals industry. This would basically see the chemicals industry pay a tax in every country where chemicals are produced of 0.5% of all sales of basic chemicals. And this would go into some sort of fund that would then be diverted to developing countries in order to help them set up chemicals management programs. The International Council for Chemicals Associations, the ICCA, which is the largest, sort of most involved chemicals industry association, they don't like this plan, and they want to have a more direct input into how any of the money that they contribute is used. So they don't want it to go into a fund where they don't have any control. They say that their role should really just be to comply with regulations in each country and then contribute to those countries' chemicals management through fee-based chemicals management systems. So think like REACH, how every chemical registration dossier comes with a fee. Now, these virtual working groups have been meeting since October, and we haven't seen a whole lot of movement until now on this discussion of private sector involvement. But last week, in the final outcome document that the working group published, there seemed to be sort of a cautious agreement by stakeholders to move forward. The document said that most stakeholders, including the NGOs and including the ICCA, they supported the general idea of an EU proposal. The EU proposed adding a paragraph to the negotiating text that says governments should implement, this is in quotes, legislation and appropriate economic instruments to further encourage private sector financing. And this references taxes as one potential route for governments to implement economic instruments, but it also references others like extended producer responsibility schemes. So this leaves the door open to that tax proposal, but it certainly doesn't indicate an intention to execute the NGO's big overarching global plan. I'd say still that the fact that everyone was on board with this proposal, or at least sort of, you know, pending final negotiations, that was a big development from this working group.
Okay, thank you, Ginger. And what of the other three working groups? What have been the key findings so far?
Sure. So there's been a lot of discussion. So I'll just give some key highlights pretty quickly. Another topic that has been creating a lot of conversation lately within the international chemicals sphere is whether the chemicals world needs a science policy interface. And this is basically, it would be a committee or a group that could bridge the gap between scientific research on chemicals and waste on one hand, and on the other hand, the governments that are drafting and implementing policies on this. This group would be up to date on the latest research and provide recommendations based on that research to governments, but then it would also go the other way, where they would relay back to the scientific community what areas of research governments would find to be the most useful or helpful. So there's been talk about a science policy interface for a while, but the news is that the working group on governance and mechanisms to support implementation, they said that all stakeholders confirmed the need for some sort of science policy interface. So the details still need to be worked out, but that's a pretty important development, and we can expect more from that in the negotiations in the future. The other two groups moved things along a bit more incrementally, we'll say. One of them was drafting targets for the text, sort of quantifiable, measurable actions that governments, industry, and NGOs should take. And they did quite a lot of work on drafting those, rewriting some, recommending new ones. And then the final group set out a process by which a topic, a group of chemicals, an issue could be nominated as an issue of concern under the framework. And an issue of concern would have sort of, it does right now, SICHEM, which is the current voluntary framework, has 8 such issues, and they are important in that all the countries have basically agreed that this is a topic that is of global concern. It's not just enough to deal with it in individual countries, and that it's a priority to tackle from the international agenda. Current issues are PFAS or endocrine disrupting chemicals or lead in paint. And so this process sets out a process, this working group sets out a process by which another issue could be nominated in the future. And if it's considered an issue of concern, then parties will make a plan to mediate its impacts around the world.
Thanks, Ginger. So what happens next in the process to establish the framework?
That's a good question, really. The working groups have done what they can virtually, but pretty much everyone is in agreement that the actual negotiations to agree on the post-2020 framework, they need to take place in person. And in this case, in-person negotiations means a few hundred people from basically every country in the world, all in a room together for a week. And as we all know, with the pandemic, it's really unclear when that will be possible. So right now, there's one more round of negotiations that's supposed to take place. And then there's the conference, the International Conference on Chemical Management, where the decision is expected to be taken. These are both on hold indefinitely. And the next meeting to discuss a timeline of when, when we can move forward is expected to be held this summer.
Okay, thanks again, Ginger. So that brings us to the end of today's episode. So thank you again to Terry, David and Ginger for sharing their insight into today's stories with us. And thank you to you, our audience, for listening to today's episode. If you would like to find out more about the topics from today's discussion, please head over to the Chemical Watch website at chemicalwatch.com. Until next week, goodbye.
Unlock the full value of your compliance and product stewardship with world-leading insight and intelligence from Chemical Watch. To find out more or request a demo, visit chemicalwatch.com. Chemical Watch. Intelligence to transform product safety.
The Chemical Watch Podcast.